Cookbooks had always intrigued and seduced me. When I was still a dilettante in the kitchen, they held my attention, even the dull ones, from cover to cover, the way crime and murder stories did, Gertrude Stein. When we first began reading Dashiell Hammett, Gertrude Stein remarked that it was his modern note to have disposed of his victims before the story commenced. Goodness knows how many were required to follow as a result of the first crime. And so it is in the kitchen. Murder and sudden death seem as unnatural there as they should be anywhere else. They can't. They can never become acceptable facts. Food is far too pleasant to combine with horror. All the same, facts, even distasteful facts, must be accepted, and we should see how before any story of cooking begins, crime is inevitable. That is why cooking is not an entirely agreeable pastime. There is too much that must happen in advance of the actual cooking. This doesn't, of course, apply to food that emerges stainless from deep freeze. But the marketing and cooking team I know are French, and it was in France, where freezing units are unknown, that in due course graduated at the stove. In earlier days, memories of which are scattered among my chapters, if indulgent friends on this or that Sunday evening or party occasion said that the cooking I produced wasn't bad, it neither beguiled nor flattered me into liking or wanting to do it. The only way to learn to cook is to cook. And for me, as for so many others, it suddenly and unexpectedly became a disagreeable necessity to have to do it when war came and occupation followed. It was on these conditions of rationing and shortage that I learned not only to cook seriously, but to buy food in a restricted market, and not to take too much time in doing it, since there were so many more important and more amusing things to do. It was at this time, then, that murder in the kitchen began. Before coming to Paris, I was interested in food, but not in doing any cooking. When in 1908 I went to live with Gertrude Stein at the Rue de Fleuries, she said we should have American food for Sunday evening supper. She had had enough French and Italian cooking. The servant would be out, and I should have the kitchen to myself. So I commenced to cook the simple dishes I had eaten in the homes of the San Joaquin Valley in California: fricasseed chicken, cornbread, apple, and lemon pie. Then, when the pie crust received Gertrude Stein's critical approval, I made mincemeat, and at Thanksgiving we had a turkey that Elaine, the cook, roasted, for which I prepared the dressing. Gertrude Stein, not being able to decide whether she preferred mushroom, chestnut, or oyster in the dressing, all three were included. The experiment was successful and frequently repeated. It gradually entered into my repertoire, which expanded as I grew experimental and adventurous. Bass for Picasso. One day when Picasso was to lunch with us, I decorated a fish in a way that I thought would amuse him. I chose a fine striped bass and cooked it according to a theory my grandmother, who had no experience in cooking and who rarely saw her kitchen, but who had endless theories about cooking as well as about many other things. She contended that a fish, having lived its life in water, once caught, should have no further contact with the element in which it had been born and raised. She recommended that it be roasted or poached in wine or cream or butter. So I made a court bouillon of dry white wine with whole pepper, salt, a laurel leaf, a sprig of thyme, a blade of mace, an onion with a clove stuck in it, a carrot, a leek, and a bouquet of fiend's herb. This was gently boiled in the fish kettle for 1/2 hour and then put aside to cool. Then the fish was placed on the rack, the fish kettle covered and slowly brought to a boil, and the fish poached for 20 minutes. Taken from the fire, it was left to cool in the courbouillon. It was then carefully drained, dried, and placed on the fish platter. A short time before serving it, I covered the fish with an ordinary mayonnaise and, using a pastry tube, decorated it with a red mayonnaise, not colored with catsup horror powders, but with tomato paste. Then I made a design with seared hard-boiled eggs, the whites and the yolks apart, with truffle and with finely chopped fiend's herb. I was proud of my chef d'oeuvre when it was served, and Picasso exclaimed at its beauty. But, said he, should it not rather have been made in honor of Matisse than of me? When the Germans in 1940 were advancing, we were in Billigny and had no precise information concerning their progress through France. Could one believe the radio? We didn't. We heard cannon fire. Then it grew louder. The next morning, dressing at the window, I saw German planes firing on French planes not more than 2 miles away. This decided me to act in the way any thoughtful housekeeper should. We would take the car into Belley and make provisions for any eventuality, as I had done that April morning of 1906, when the fire in San Francisco had broken out after the earthquake. Then I had been able to secure 2 hams. My father had brought back 400 cigarettes. With these one might, he said, not only exist, but be able to be hospitable. So at Burley we bought 2 hams and hundreds of cigarettes and some groceries. The garden at Billigny would provide fruit and vegetables. The main road was filled with refugees, just as it had been in 1914 and in 1917. Everything that was happening had already been experienced, like a half awakening from a nightmare. The firing grew louder, and then the first armored car flew past. Crushed, we took the dust road back to Billigny. The widow Rue, who for many summers had been our devoted servant, and later during the occupation proved to be our loyal friend, opened the big iron gates to let the car through, and we unloaded the provisions. What were we to do with the 2 enormous, uncooked hams? In what could we cook them, and in what way, so that they would keep indefinitely? We decided upon eau de vie de mar, for which the Bourget is well known. It seemed madly extravagant, but we lived on those 2 hams during the long, lean winter that followed, and well into the following spring. And the eau de vie de mar, in which they were cooked, carefully bottled and corked, toned up winter vegetables. We threw nothing, but absolutely nothing away, living through a war in an occupied country. When, during the summer of 1934, Gertrude Stein could not decide whether she did or did not want to go to the United States, one of the things that troubled her was the question of the food she would be eating there. Would it be to her taste? A young man from the Bourget had lately returned from a brief visit to the United States and had reported that the food was more foreign to him than the people, their homes, or the way they lived in them. He said that food was good, but very strange indeed. Tinned vegetable cocktails and tinned fruit salads for example. Surely, said I, you weren't required to eat them. You could have substituted other dishes, not, said he, when you were a guest. At this time, they were staying with us at Bélinger, an American friend who said he would send us a menu from the restaurant of the hotel we would be staying at when Gertrude Stein lectured in his hometown, which he did promptly on his return there. The variety of dishes was a pleasant surprise, even if the tinned vegetable cocktails and fruit salads occupied a preponderous position. Consolingly, there were honeydew melons, soft shell crabs, and prime roast beef. We could undertake a great adventure. Gertrude Stein said she was not going to lunch or dine with anyone before lecturing. We would eat simply and alone. Before her first lecture, she ordered for dinner oysters and honeydew melon. She said it would suit her. In traveling to a dozen states, she deviated as little as possible from that first menu. Occasionally, the oysters had to be replaced by fish or chicken. From the beginning, the ubiquitous honeydew melon bored me. Melons, to me, are a hot weather refreshment. Rooms heated to 70 degrees and over do not replace the sun. In any case, I prefer the flavor of Spanish melons to honeydew and Persian melons. So the most fantastic dishes were experimented with, anything except what sounded like drugstore specialties. When we were at St. Paul, to our surprise and delight, there was a telephone message from Sherwood Anderson. He had heard we were in the neighborhood. He proposed calling for us and driving us down to meet his wife. They were staying with her sister and their brother-in-law, which he did through miles of ice and snowdrifts to Sweet People and a festival dinner. It was the happiest of meetings. Of all the delicacies served, it is strange to remark that it was the first time we tasted mint jelly. In Columbus, Ohio, there was a small restaurant that served meals that would have been my pride if they had come to our table from our kitchen. The cooks were women, and the owner was a woman, and it was managed by women. The cooking was beyond compare, neither fluffy nor emaciated, as women's cooking can be, but succulent and savory. Later, at Fort Worth, there was a similar restaurant to which Miss Ella Hockaday introduced us. We were to fly out to California, and the restaurant packed us a box of food that was the best picnic lunch ever was. It would be a pleasure to be able to order something approaching it when taking a plane today. Has food on the American planes, not the transatlantic flight, but on interior routes, improved? It has not in Europe. It is incredibly bad, even worse than on trains. Do they cook these meals in the locomotive and in the fuselage? At Detroit, there was a strange incident at the hotel which seemed sinister to us. The hardened European visitors became frightened. Gertrude Stein had the habit of an hour's walk after the evening meal, improperly spoken of as dinner. To calm her mind, she went off for a walk. But in a short time, she returned quite agitated. Not far from the hotel, from the loudspeaker on a tower, with a revolving searchlight, a warning was being repeated that no one was to move until a gunman was caught. A murder had just been committed. Suddenly, Joseph Brewer's name flashed into my mind. Had we not said we would stay with him if we were in his neighborhood? He was the president of Olivet College, So we telephoned him and said we should like to be rescued. He said he would come to collect us and our bags, which he did the next morning. Food in the Bugey during the occupation. In the beginning, like camels, we lived on our past. We had been well nourished. The Bugey is famous for its food, and we didn't feel hungry until some weeks after strict rationing had been enforced. The meat allowance of 1/4 pound a week per person was not altogether satisfying, but until the occupation powers forbade fishing, the Rhone Valley supplied us with salmon trout and the Lait de Bourget with the rare salmon carp, Orme Chevalier, Laveray, and Perch. From the vegetable garden, we had quantities of all kinds of vegetables and fruits of an excellent quality. In the wine cellars, a delicious dry white wine. We were really very well off. What was lacking was milk, butter, and eggs. There was an infinitesimal amount of these on our ration cards, but by the time the Germans had collected their requisitioning, there was nothing left to distribute to the inhabitants. The German soldiers were interested in butter. It appeared that many of them had never tasted it. Had not Hitler asked them if they wanted butter or guns, and had they not given the right answer? One day, marketing for whatever unrationed food might be still for sale, a German soldier came into the shop. He pointed to a huge mound of butter and said, 1 kilo. 1 kilo, the clerk explained. The German nodded his head impatiently. The butter was weighed and wrapped up. Unwrapping one end of the package, the German walked out of the shop. From the open door where I was standing, I saw him bite off a piece of the butter. It evidently was not what he expected it to be, for with a brusque movement, he threw it violently over the garden wall of the house opposite. The story got about. People came to look at it. No one would touch it. There it stayed. The farmers about us would not sell their produce. They would barter it for coffee, sugar, men's boots and shirts, and women's smocks. We, of course, had none of these things up in the attic, as all French families had. One day the Germans forbade fishing, so we went into Burley to see our nice butcher. He explained that the Germans rationed him to the amount of his clients' coupons, but he could regularly get us crawfish. They were caught higher up in the Valrhône, preferably in an open umbrella with bait attached to the ends of the ribs. That is the way we had been taught to fish them. The next morning, the nice butcher came out on his bicycle to Billignac with a sack on his back, 200 crawfish, which he emptied into the trough and covered with planks to protect them against the sun. He gave me a few scraps of meat with which to feed them. The sum I paid was astronomical. 3 days later, he came out with an equal number. We could commence to give lunch parties. Friends would come out to have a cup of real China tea with us. With economy, the £10 friend had sent us from the United States in the summer of 1939 lasted until the liberation. Gertrude Stein had bought for me all the American cigarettes she could find. If they weren't nourishing, they certainly acted as a stimulant at this time. Hospitality consisted in 2 cups of tea without sugar, milk or lemon, and 1 cigarette. One somber afternoon, I saw the good Widow Rue, who was our handyman, going to the Pottles with a pail in either hand. "What have you got there?" I asked. "Our dishwater for the Mother Veen's pig," she answered. "Listen," I said, "you tell her, if she isn't ready to sell us an egg a day, you won't bring her any more dishwater for her pig." The Mother Veen accepted the proposal, and our diet was appreciatively increased. It was a manna from heaven. With reasonable calculation, if the Mother Veen was now selling us one egg a day, in a short while, when her hens began to lay normally again, she would certainly be willing to sell us two a day. It was a comforting thought, but a few days before Christmas, my hopes were shattered. The Mother Veen's son told me that he was killing the pig for the holidays, as they would no longer have any need for the dishwater. His mother wanted to say that she was not selling us an egg each day. It was a blow. Perhaps something else would turn up. When we came to Bilinya, there was one pear, one plum, and one apple tree in the garden, and all of them were old. With the landlord's permission, we had the plum tree removed at once. Everything was done, but to no avail, to save the deep rose-colored pear tree. That left one excellent large apple tree. For an orchard, it was not excessive. Gertrude Stein spoke of it as the nucleus. We waited for 3 years until we secured a lease to plant apples, peaches, apricots, and nectarines. The French liked to plant fruit trees in the old-fashioned way on the sunny side of the wall. There were only two such walls free, and a fine old laurel tree covered a part of one of them. The laurel was a constant delight. There was a nameless mauve rose that cried for a border of laurel leaves. A bouquet of them was always in the bedroom of our young guests, writers and painters, and occasionally musicians, as a symbol of future wreaths. None of them remarked the leaves. The peaches, apricots, and nectarines were not for long. They deteriorated in 3 or 4 years. It was not a soil or a climate that suited them. We were slow to learn this. As the apples were thriving, more of them replaced the fruits we were discarding. The famous Calveel, of which the equally famous Calvados, an apple brandy, is not made, and the Resembelfeuille zone grew quickly and well. But fruit trees on a wall are not prolific. The Calveels, sold by the piece in Paris, grew no more than 40 to the tree. It was necessary to find a commoner, more hardy apple, and to plant it in open ground, what the French, looking facts in the face, call open to the winds. And then we finally had an apple orchard. The forcing beds were returned to their sheltered home against the wall. When autumn came, the last harvest was so occupying that one forgot that it meant leaving the garden for the return to Paris. Not only did the winter vegetables have to be gathered and placed to dry for a day before packing, but their roots and leaves had to be put on the compost heap with manure and leaves and packed down for the winter. The day the huge baskets were packed was my proudest of all the year. The cold sun would shine on the orange-colored carrots, the green, yellow, and white pumpkins and squash, the purple eggplants, and a few last red tomatoes. They made for me more poignant than any other post-impressionist picture. Merely to look at them made all the rest of the year's pleasure insignificant. Gertrude Stein took a more practical attitude. She came out into the denuded, wet, cold garden, and looking at the number of baskets and crates, asked if they were all being sent to Paris, that if they were, expressage would ruin us. She thought that there was enough vegetables for an institution and reminded me that our whole household consisted of three people. There was no question that, looking at that harvest as an economic question, it was disastrous. But from the point of view of the satisfaction which work and aesthetic confer, it was sublime. Our final definite leaving of the garden came one cold winter day, all too appropriate to our feelings and the state of the world. A sudden moment of sunshine peopled the garden with all the friends and others who had passed through them. Ah, there would be another garden. The same friends, possibly, or no, probably new ones. And there would be other stories to tell and to hear. And so we left Binningham, never to return. And now it amuses me to remember that the only confidence I ever gave was given twice in the upper garden to two friends. The first one gaily responded, "How very amusing." The other one asked, with no little alarm, "But Alice, have you ever tried to write?" As if a cookbook had anything to do with writing. The recipe for hashish fudge was given me by Brian Geisen, which anyone could wish up on a rainy day. This is the food of paradise, a Baudelaire's artificial paradise. It might provide an entertaining refreshment for a ladies' bridge club or a chapter meeting of the DAR. In Morocco, it is thought to be good for warding off the common cold in damp winter weather, and is, indeed, more effective if taken with large quantities of hot mint tea. Euphoria and brilliant storms of laughter, ecstatic reveries, an extension of one's personality on several simultaneous planes are to be complacently expected. Almost anything Santa Teresa did, you can do better if you can bear to be ravished by an évanouissement réveillé. Take 1 teaspoon black peppercorn, 1 whole nutmeg, 4 average sticks of cinnamon, 1 teapot coriander. These should all be pulverized in a mortar. About a handful each of stoned dates, dried figs, shelled almonds, and peanuts. Chop these and mix them together. A bunch of Cannabis sativa can be pulverized. This along with the spices should be dusted over the mixed fruit and nuts, kneaded together. About 1 cup of sugar dissolved in a big pat of butter, rolled into a cake and cut into pieces or made into balls about the size of a walnut. It should be eaten with care. 2 pieces are quite sufficient. Obtaining the cannabis may present certain difficulties, but the variety known as Cannabis sativa grows as a common weed, often unrecognized, everywhere in Europe, Asia, and parts of Africa, besides being cultivated as a crop in the manufacture of rope. In the Americas, while often discouraged, its cousin called Cannabis indica has been observed even in city window boxes. It should be picked and dried as soon as it has gone to seed while the plant is still green. The recipe was innocently included without my realizing that the hashish was the accented part of the recipe, and that I was shocked to find that America wouldn't accept it because it was too dangerous. Well, this was an offense to the American eye and the American thought, because they were afraid they were up against the law. And so my publisher wired to Washington and asked the administration if it were possible to use such a recipe. When it appeared, there'd been an outcry. The magazines took it up. And he got as an answer from Washington, "You may do anything you please except eat it. That is forbidden by law. You may grow it, you may manufacture it, but you may not sell it, and you may not eat it." Brian Geisen himself wired me and said, "What are we doing about this?" And I said, "I'm doing nothing. What can you do?" I was shocked to find that it was hashish. I thought it was just a joke of his. And he said, "Well, something should be done." And so he wired to the editor, who paid no attention to him. He said it was too late, later in conversation. So that was that. It never went into the American edition. The English are braver. We're not courageous about that sort of thing. The Autobiography of Alice B. Toklas by Gertrude Stein. Before I came to Paris, I was born in San Francisco, California. I have, in consequence, always preferred living in a temperate climate. But it is so difficult on the continent of Europe, or even in America, to find a temperate climate and to live in it. My mother's father was a pioneer. He came to California in 49. He married my grandmother, who was very fond of music. She was a pupil of Clara Schumann's father. My mother was a quiet, charming woman named Emily. My father came of Polish patriotic stock. His granduncle raised a regiment for Napoleon and was its colonel. His father left his mother just after their marriage to fight at the barricades in Paris. But his wife having cut off his supplies, he soon returned and led the life of a conservative, well-to-do landowner. I myself have had no liking for violence and have always enjoyed the pleasures of needlework and gardening. I'm fond of painting, furniture, tapestry, houses, and flowers, and even vegetables and fruit trees. I like a view, but I like to sit with my back turned to it. I led in my childhood and youth the gently bred existence of my class and kind. I had some intellectual adventures at this period, but very quiet ones. When I was about 19 years of age, I was a great admirer of Henry James. I felt that The Awkward Age would make a very remarkable play, and I wrote to Henry James suggesting that I dramatize it. I had from him a delightful letter on the subject, and then, when I felt my inadequacy, rather blushed for myself and did not keep the letter. Perhaps at that time I did not feel that I was justified in preserving it. At any rate, it no longer exists. Up to my 20th year, I was seriously interested in music. I studied and practiced assiduously. But shortly then, it seemed futile. My mother had died, and there was no unconquerable sadness, but there was no real interest that led me on. From then on, for about 6 years, I was well occupied. I led a pleasant life. I had many friends, much amusement, many interests. My life was reasonably full, and I enjoyed it, but I was not very ardent in it. This brings me to the San Francisco fire, which had as a consequence that the elder brother of Gertrude Stein and his wife came back from Paris to San Francisco, and this led to a complete change in my life. I was at this time living with my father and brother. My father was a quiet man who took things quietly, although he felt them deeply. The first terrible morning of the San Francisco fire, I woke him and told him, "The city has been rocked by an earthquake. It is now on fire." "That will give us a black eye in the east," he replied, turning and going to sleep again. I remember that once when my brother and a comrade had gone horseback riding, one of the horses returned riderless to the hotel. The mother of the other boy began to make a terrible scene. "Be calm, madam," said my father. "Perhaps it is my son who has been killed." One of his axioms I always remember: if you must do a thing, do it graciously. He also told me that a hostess should never apologize for any failure in her household arrangements. If there is a hostess, there is, insofar as there is a hostess, no failure. As I was saying, we were all living comfortably together, and there had been in my mind no active desire or thought of change. The disturbance of the routine of our lives by the fire, followed by the coming of Gertrude Stein's older brother and his wife, made the difference. Mrs. Stein brought with her three little Matisse paintings, the first modern things to cross the Atlantic. I made her acquaintance at this time of general upset, and she showed them to me. She also told me many stories of her life in Paris. Gradually, I told my father that perhaps I would leave San Francisco. He was not disturbed by this, after all. There was, at that time, a great deal of coming and going, and there were many friends of mine going. Within a year, I also had gone, and I had come to Paris. There I went to see Mrs. Stein, who had in the meantime returned to Paris, and there at our house I met Gertrude Stein. I was impressed by the coral brooch she wore and by her voice. I may say that only three times in my life have I met a genius, and each time a bell within me rang, and I was not mistaken. And I may say in each case it was before there was any general recognition of the quality of genius in them. The three geniuses of whom I wish to speak are Gertrude Stein, Pablo Picasso, and Alfred Whitehead. I have met many important people. I've met several great people, but I've only known three first-class geniuses, and in each case, on sight within me, something rang. In no one of the three cases have I been mistaken. In this way, my new full life began. I met her through her brother and sister-in-law, who were already in Paris when we arrived there in 1907. And we went to see them that same afternoon that we arrived, because they were intimate friends of the friend with whom I had come over. And she said, "I made an appointment with them, so we'll go over for a little while." I had found, through a friend, an extremely nice hotel, which is still in existence in Paris, called the Magellan. And the Magellan is just as it was, old-fashioned, traditional, luxurious, beautiful hotel. And so we went over there. And there, when we got there, there was Gertrude Stein. And I knew it was she from photographs I'd seen. And at once, I knew her voice as being something apart. She had a deep, rich contralto voice that was natural to her. And I thought it came from the red coral brooch she was wearing. It was so wonderful, such a beautiful voice. And she had an exceptional, rare laugh. It was very hearty, fairly loud, but oh, it was music. She didn't play it, it just was itself. And she sat there and we talked and we made an appointment.